Welcome to this week's podcast for Friday 16th November with me, Ian Welsh. Coming up is our usual roundup of news and comment. Plus, when he was in London last month at Innovation Forum's Business and Human Rights event, my colleague Toby Webb spoke with David Westlake, CEO of the International Justice Mission, about how companies can help build capacity to eliminate modern slavery in Thailand specifically. And when I was in Detroit recently, I caught up with Joe Arvai, Faculty Director of the Erb Institute at the University of Michigan, and we debated the challenges for businesses to measure their impacts and outcomes. Before that, though, our weekly review of some of what's happening in business and sustainability. The latest analysis by the Corporate Human Rights Benchmark of 100 leading companies in the apparel, agriculture and extractive sectors suggests that most of them are still failing to meet the UN's human rights standards, which cover the likes of tackling child labour, modern slavery and gender inequality. The sectors are chosen as the ones with greatest human rights abuse risks. Using publicly available information, including, for example, transparency, wages and labour rights, the CHRB's research put sportswear giant Adidas in first place, ahead of the extractive sectors Rio Tinto and BHP Billiton. Companies propping up the bottom of the list include Starbucks, Prada and Hermes, who reacted with unsurprising disappointment, reaffirming commitments to human rights. A poor score in the benchmark doesn't suggest poor actual performance, but rather that the company has made little effort to make information on its activities publicly available. For companies that do want to be better at transparently talking about what they are doing about modern slavery, and specifically in producing the sort of statements required under the UK's Modern Slavery Act and legislation elsewhere, help is at hand in the shape of a new framework from the Ethical Trading Initiative. This is designed as a how-to guide to writing a good statement, which is crucial given the Modern Slavery Registry has found that less than one-fifth of statements in the UK alone meet minimum legal standards. This week, the Roundtable on Sustainable Palm Oil's annual meeting has been ongoing in Malaysia, and we'll be analysing the outcomes in the podcast and the Innovation Forum newsletter over the coming weeks. Alongside the deliberations and debate, supermarket chain Iceland, which has pledged to eliminate palm oil from its own brand food products, has been hitting the headlines once again. Iceland had rebadged a Greenpeace animated film to lead its Christmas advertising campaign. The short film features a baby orangutan interacting with a young child, highlighting the plight of orangutans linked to deforestation for palm oil plantations. It's an emotional 90 seconds, it's been doing the rounds on social media, and is on YouTube in several guises if you've not seen it. Unfortunately for Iceland, the advert has not been cleared for release on television. Because it was originally a Greenpeace film, and as the campaigner works to change and influence laws, it breaches the UK's rules banning political advertising. The move has prompted 850,000 people to sign an online petition calling for the advert to be screened. So whatever the pros and cons of an outright ban on palm oil, Iceland has certainly achieved its aim of highlighting the issue in the run-up to the holiday period. Elsewhere, a new report published in Global Environmental Change suggests that the world's largest asset managers could play a key role in protecting the Amazon rainforest and as a bulwark against changes the new Brazilian president, Jair Bolsonaro, looks likely to implement, relaxing protection of virgin forests and natural vegetation. The report points out that major US asset managers, in particular such as BlackRock, Vanguard and State Street, hold significant amounts of stock in the beef and soy companies that would be most likely to expand operations in the Amazon if relaxed regulation allows. Commentators see this as a further evidence for the ever-growing importance of finance in helping drive the anti-deforestation agenda, which is put into further stark relief by new research from Climate Transparency, whose Brown to Green 2018 report highlights the lack of progress of the G20 economies in decarbonising energy supply. 15 of the G20 reported a rise in emissions in 2017, with 82% of energy in these countries coming from fossil fuels. Despite pledges to eliminate them, fossil fuel subsidies in the G20 increased from $75 billion in 2007 to $147 billion in 2016. Climate Transparency says that on the basis of current commitments, the world is in course for a 3.2 Celsius rise in global temperatures, way beyond the 1.5 Celsius that science now says is the only hope to save vital global ecosystems. Only India is in course to do its bit to see temperatures increases remaining under 2 Celsius. The worst offenders, the research says, are Russia, Saudi Arabia and Turkey. And the report's authors blame the entrenched interests of the fossil fuel sector fighting against increasingly competitively priced renewable alternatives. There will be lots to talk about at the upcoming COP24 climate talks in Poland in a few weeks, not least around the role of business. And IKEA's former Chief Sustainability Officer Steve Howard is the latest high-profile business figure to warn that companies which don't set bold targets in climate and other sustainability KPIs will risk becoming irrelevant for consumers and for investors. Howard, who now heads the We Mean Business Coalition, wants business to lead the big disruptive change required to grapple effectively the challenges from climate change, resource scarcity and social inequality. Finally, returning to reporting and disclosure, there was some news for corporate reporters with the launch of a new Better Alignment initiative from the Corporate Reporting Dialogue, the body for cooperation between the various reporting frameworks and standards out there, such as GRI, the Sustainability Accounting Standards Board, and the rest. The new two-year project commits the various bodies to find ways to better align the various sustainability reporting frameworks and to integrate financial and non-financial reporting. Anything that can help make reporting transparently more straightforward will be welcomed. And here's hoping the Better Alignment project achieves its objectives. Do check out Innovation Forum's 2019 conference programme and get the dates in your diary. The roster will include new events on the future for food, apparel supply chains, modern slavery, climate change and the developing bioeconomy. Details of where and when these events will be held in Europe and North America are available in this week's newsletter. Interview time now. At Innovation Forum's Business, Human Rights and Modern Slavery Conference in London last month, Toby Webb interviewed CEO of the International Justice Mission, David Westlake.
Now, David, welcome. That's an ambitious name, isn't it? The International Justice Mission. So tell us briefly, what kind of mission are you on for international justice?
So thank you. And we started 20 years ago in the aftermath of the Rwandan genocide. And the basic thought was, can justice systems around the world, the police, the prosecutors, the court systems, can they actually deliver justice and protection consistently and constantly for the poorest, most vulnerable people? That was the guiding thought. We got into the slavery area because slavery is one of the most brutal manifestations of when justice is failing vulnerable people. And today we work in 17 places around the world actively, and we work with local justice systems to rescue victims, to prosecute perpetrators, to see them convicted, to train the police and the prosecutors and so on to make that possible, and to obviously work with survivors in a whole aftercare system.
And where does the money come from?
The money comes largely from individuals, from some trusts, and from some community groups like churches or the Rotary Club, those kinds of things. But over the last couple of years, the advent of the modern slavery acts around the world has opened up a new front in the fight against slavery and also opened up new partnerships with some big corporates.
And let's talk about that. I'd like to talk mainly in this podcast about Thailand. It's been in the news a lot the last few years. And from what we heard yesterday here at our Modern Slavery Conference, it's getting a bit better, but it's by no means fixed yet. No. So specifically, what are you doing in Thailand? And what's the role of big business in working with you to help try and get some of this very difficult work around enforcement and rescue of victims done?
Thailand, like most other jurisdictions in the world, has some completely adequate slavery legislation. The issue is how well is it being understood and implemented on the ground. So we were in a conversation with Walmart, the world's largest retailer, who gain a lot of their shrimp products from the Gulf of Thailand and the Thai fishing fleet in the Gulf of Thailand. And they were aware that there was a problem here. They could do audits and so on for their tier one, maybe their tier two suppliers, but their supply chain is longer and more complex than that. And so they were concerned that the Modern Slavery Act put an obligation on them. I think they were concerned because nobody actually wants to be involved with slavery. And they were concerned because they had a brand reputation risk as well. So what to do? They talked to us about, let's first of all find out what is the scale of the problem in the Thai fishing fleet. Let's start with an evidence base. And we did a tool that we've used around the world called a prevalence study, which takes the desk research, it takes knowledge and wisdom from a number of actors and organisations, but also matches that with on-the-ground physical research of what's going on. And that showed that in the Thai fishing fleet, there was around 70% chance of slavery having been
What are the numbers?
Occurred.
What's the total number of people? More or less? Hundreds of thousands? Tens of thousands?
It's something like a couple of hundred thousand people.
That's a lot.
Yeah, it's a big industry. And that, and so around 70% of people were exhibiting one of the signs of slavery having happened to them. So coercion, violence, theft of or removal of documents, and so on. So what that meant for Walmart was, even if they were as clean as it was possible to be, they were swimming in a swamp. And even if they dived in clean, they were coming up muddy because it was a cesspit. We said to them, it is not your job to clean up the Thai fishing fleet. It's just not your job. It's the government's job. So how can you, as a corporate citizen, a good corporate citizen, mm-hmm. use your influence, your contacts, your money to help that process? So we designed a project there working with Thai police, which helped that police force and the prosecutors and the officials behind all of that to identify where slavery was happening, plan rescues and raids, arrest the perpetrators and see those cases come through the court. So that's what we're doing now.
And where is that at the moment in terms of numbers? You said earlier, it's the session we just ran, it's early days.
It is.
But give us some idea of
where we've seen the first couple of hundred people saved from slavery, so rescued, and we've seen about eight people through the court system to date. We would expect that to increase in scale and scope as the years go by. We built this model on sex trafficking, and the Gates Foundation did research on the model in the Philippines. And over a four-year period, this approach of building evidence, arresting perpetrators, saw a 79% drop in the number of children being sold for sex in the sex industry in Cebu.
So the scale bit is not necessarily about getting to 10,000 convictions. It's about at what point does what you have done send a message?
Indeed.
And so how do you work out what that point is? How do you know when the message has been sent? I guess you see over time a right kind of drop
so
in the
So what we will then go back and do is a prevalence study, okay. which says, having got a baseline...
Yeah.
Really what's happened.
Yes, so over 5 years later or yeah. something, you can work it out. And what I really like about this Walmart Foundation funding you've got is it's not them saying, let's clean up our supply chain and have an island of excellence in a cesspit or whatever, which you see a lot with companies,
yeah.
or walk away, you know, stuff. But also that they're tackling a genuine institutional problem. How long is the project with them? Because that's the other challenge, is this is a long-term thing,
yeah.
right? So that what happens in 5 years with them? What's the length of this?
Yeah, so we'll review this with them, or they'll review it with us in terms of funding thing in a couple of years' time. So it'll be like a five-year project.
Okay.
But the project that we will do will continue. We think, from other settings, in other sorts of places, we think that in a period of around 12 years, mm-hmm. you see demonstrable change.
12 years?
Yeah.
Okay, that's interesting.
And partly that's about, it just takes time to take things through court systems.
Of course. And so what you're doing is you're hiring or funding undercover journalism investigators, and what you're doing is you're saying to the police, here's a load of research, if you go and raid this factory or whatever, you will find this, and here's all the evidence you need to get a conviction.
Yeah.
So that they go, okay, that's worth our time and effort.
Yeah, so
is that the majority of your work, or are you also running training classes where the cops sit down in front of a PowerPoint slide and you tell them what human rights is? I mean, what's the balance?
So it's all of the above. So we work really closely with the police. It's not we don't have the authority to investigate. The police have the authority to investigate.
Yeah, you have to be careful. You don't
so
want to
we
do their job.
We work with the police in helping them do that. We provide some skills gaps sometimes. We provide some extra manpower to do that, to get that evidence and the chain of evidence well and strong. Alongside that, though, is absolutely training. So some of that is just about training people in what their own laws say and yeah. how to get those kinds of cases through the courts. Some of it, we're really aware of the complexity around taking vulnerable people, brutalised people, through giving evidence, presenting evidence in court, being cross-examined. So some of yeah. it is about just helping court systems cope with those vulnerable people.
And helping witnesses cope with the process.
And helping witnesses cope with the process. So we've done things where we've trained magistrates, we've trained police officers, we've trained prosecutors.
This is such a fascinating area, and I've spoken to you before that I wrote my master's dissertation about this. 10 years ago, I did a report on this, and I remember my case studies no longer exist, basically. And some of the companies that did them don't even know that they did them. And it's been a personal fascination of mine that we could fix these problems if we focused some time and resources on them, or we could contribute as a business movement, if you like, in sustainability. Yet nobody does, really. Who else is doing this apart from you guys? Do you know about other organisations that are doing this kind of work?
Oh, I mean, I think what we're seeing in the world at the moment is a whole wave of abolitionist movement, of anti-slavery organisations. And I think my sense is that there's lots of organisations that have one piece of the jigsaw puzzle. So our piece of the jigsaw puzzle is about this casework model and taking that through, and that's what we do. There are other organisations that are doing community-based education, that are doing all sorts of other things.
But there needs to be another 10 of you guys doing what you do specifically, I would argue.
Yes.
Or would that create 10 different systems? But then you can't have one giant NGO, I guess, can you?
So I think one of the things that we've seen that's been really encouraging in India is that we have worked with another 30 organisations in India to take our experience and learning a model so that they can replicate that.
The grassroots kind of...
Yeah.
Empowerment approach.
And that will, I think, as there's much more sharing of the intellectual property, as there's much more sharing of the experience.
It's all open source.
It brings a momentum.
And then they have local buy-in because they're local people.
Indeed.
And you can help them get funding. Let's talk about the police again specifically. You've mentioned to me in the past, I think, that 1 in 20 police chiefs wanted to talk to you in Thailand. Is that changing?
No, so this is the internal anecdote about when we enter a setting, that there's roughly 20% of the police, and indeed the district officials system and everything, who are utterly colluding with organised crime. They've got their hands in the till. They're part of the problem. You've got 20% of the people who are appalled that this stuff's going on in their country. They're offended by it. Their sense of justice and right cause bristles, and they want to do something about it. They got into law enforcement in order to enforce the law. And you've got a whole lump in the middle who, frankly, are overworked and underpaid and stressed out.
Yeah, and they're just trying to get through the
week. And they're getting through the week.
So how do we get the good 20% to tip the middle 60% against the bad 20%? How does that work?
Yeah, so I think one of the most effective ways we've found is an absolute social movement approach, which is you find somebody who's really doing good stuff and they've done good stuff, and you make a lot of noise about them. You put them up for awards and you do PR around them so they're in the paper and you lobby for their promotion, and suddenly that's the good person. That's the successful person.
You make good
person.
Aspirational.
Yeah.
Thai fishing industry in general, big splash about it, no pun intended, a few years ago. By what percentage has it improved? If I had to ask you, I'm asking you these ridiculous questions about, asking you to put specifics on very difficult areas, I know that, but I'm just trying to get a sense of progress here. I mean, Thai Union have totally changed their entire business model, as far as I understand, in terms of how they work with ships as a result of this. But that cleans up their supply chain, which is kind of their job in a way.
Yeah.
And I know they've done lots of government lobbying as well
on
broader human rights issues, I know that. They've done, I think, a really interesting job. But what about the rest of it? There's you guys, Walmart, Thai Union, is the rest of it moving or is it sort of bumbling along?
So the experience of what we've had in different parts of the world is that, and this is what the Gates Foundation found when they researched our model, is that two things happen. One is the situation in that setting improves because people who are buying and selling other people are in prison and not doing it. But there's a multiplier effect which says that buying and selling humans in that setting has suddenly become more dangerous for the traffickers. So it's a less attractive business opportunity. And that effect is very, very powerful. So I mentioned in the Philippines, we saw drops of 79 to 84% over a period of 4 years of minors being involved in the sex industry. In Thailand, we would expect something similar to that over a period of time because it just becomes more dangerous. People who traffic young men or children from Cambodia into the fishing fleet are going to get caught, or they're scared they're going to get caught.
Yeah,
and
deterrence. Yeah.
There's a real deterrence.
So you feel like they're going in the right direction?
Yes, yes. And there's all sorts of other things that need to go alongside that. So education
and
good working practice and all that kind of stuff as well.
And the institutions need to be strengthened. So if you get numbers like you have in the Philippines, they look great for 5 or 10 years, and then 15 years later, you've slipped back to where you were if you're not careful, right?
Yeah.
So it's the solidity of functioning institutions.
Yeah.
That's a next level challenge, I guess.
And this is where actually the social movement of global recognition comes in as well.
Mm-hmm.
So the Cambodian police, we worked with them over a period of about 15 years. Again, that was about minors in the sex industry, where Cambodia was an absolute mecca for Western sex tourism. Well, the Cambodian police now have a world-class anti-trafficking unit that's fighting minors in the sex industry.
And that's had a big impact on...
That has a big impact, but also it's a massive impact in terms of the standing of Cambodia and the pride of the law enforcement and the country in that. And you see some of the advantages, some of these global league tables and reports and everything, is that countries don't want to be at the bottom.
No.
So there's something there about having made an improvement, you keep that improvement.
Now, you're also working with Target. That's a big US retailer. Just to finish off, tell us about that.
Well, so Target, very, very similar kind of thought process. They have a whole web of suppliers across India. And they were really aware that again, they could do audits, which would get them so far.
Yeah.
But the people coming into the factories, the Weber factories that they used, it was a murky world. And so they particularly identified, or we identified with them particularly, the need for safe migration practices. So lots in India, lots of people moving from rural settings to cities. Mm-hmm. How could that work and how could they be protected there? Very similar model of what we do on the ground.
And that's a new partnership. So it's just
a new partnership
in its early stages.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, let's see how that pans out. We'll sit down again in a year or so and have a further chat about it. In the meantime, David Westlake, thank you so much for your time today. Listeners, if you'd like to know more about IJM, just Google International Justice Mission, and I'm sure you can see more on their website. In the meantime, David, thanks a lot for your time.
Thank you.
When I was in Detroit a few weeks ago, I spoke with Joe Arvai, Professor of Sustainable Business and Head of Faculty at the Urb Institute, University of Michigan.
Let's reflect on some of the things we've been hearing today in the conference. What do you think are the biggest challenges for business to measure their impacts right now?
You know, I think there are a couple of challenges. One is, and it's kind of ironic, but there's no shortage of data out there, but there's a lot of noise in that data, and there's a lot of data that one can have access to. So I almost think that there's information overload from the standpoint of companies when it comes to measuring their impact. So I think that's one challenge. I think the other challenge that's big is that a lot of companies are still confusing impact and outcomes. So I think of outcomes as something that you would measure as sort of a benchmark, against a benchmark that is kind of a measure of incremental progress on a path to sustainability that you're on. So you're always sort of looking at how your outcomes are performing according to some prior benchmark. Impact to me is whether or not you're actually achieving your fundamental goals. By and large, organizations, large organizations and small ones, have a hard time measuring what it is they fundamentally want to achieve. I mean, obviously, profitability is a big one. But in the sustainability space, there's so much more to it. And I just think that it's not being defined well. And I'll say this, to not suggest that I'm kicking at business or government or large organizations. As individuals, we struggle with this very same thing. So it's not a surprise to me that this is happening at the larger scale.
I think you're right. Do you not think, though, that there is a real development in companies thinking, though, why are we here? What's our reason for being?
Oh, absolutely. I think that's the most positive thing to come out of the corporate sustainability movement is the exploration of organizational purpose. What is the company there to do? A lot of companies, certainly the very respected companies now, the Fortune 50, the Fortune 500, to some degree are taking a deeper inward look as to what their purpose is beyond profitability. I think some are taking enormous strides to actually leave profits on the table when other kinds of sustainability objectives are at stake. So I think these are massive steps forward. But nevertheless, I think every single one of those organizations could be better. And this gets back to your first question of, well, you know, is the data out there to help them? And the answer is yes and no.
Thinking about materiality, which is something we covered earlier on, to what extent do you think there's still a disconnect for business between what they think is material compared to what actually is material for them?
That's a really interesting question. So I think organizations, large organizations that are populated by incredibly bright and talented people, I think there's a natural tendency there for them to maybe make some bold predictions about certainly what's important to them as an organization, speaking on behalf of a collective, but then also to make some predictions or some declarative statements about what ought to be important out there in the world, whether it's environment or society. So I think that right there, we have a problem that's related to one of the things that I studied in my lab, and that's sort of attributional biases. How do we think of ourselves in terms of being able to predict or explain what's important to others? And how good do we think we are at being able to explain our behavior or what's important to us? And those aren't without their challenges. So I think the big challenge out there is really in being a little bit too bold in assuming that you know what's important out there or even important within the organization. So I think a lot of insularity, going back to your question about materiality assessments, a lot of kind of groupthink around what's material, and in many cases, in my opinion anyway, not enough deeper exploration about not just what's material, but how we actually think about and go about sort of characterizing materiality.
And the risk is, of course, that companies, they don't want to find out what's material because you know, the really big challenges that we've been talking about, you know, well, that's not our problem. Is that something you see?
Absolutely. And you know, I hate to get kind of jargony with you, but I will anyway, because I am a professor. We talk about errors of commission and errors of omission. When it comes to individuals and groups, which include corporations, it's a lot more comfortable to make an error of omission. In other words, I made a mistake or I didn't perform as well as I would have liked to have performed because I didn't have all the information at my fingertips. There's sort of a built-in get out of jail free card in there. Versus the more uncomfortable option, which is the error of commission, that, you know, I had all the information at my fingertips, it just led me down the wrong path. And usually the finger gets pointed at the people who are making the choices there. So I think it's something that you see in business with respect to how they make strategic decisions. And I think you're right. I think a lot of organizations would, all things being equal, I think they'll say that they want to know everything, but it gives them a little bit of extra autonomy if they don't.
One of the really big things in the last few years has been the development and rise of the Sustainable Development Goals. How big an impact do you think that the SDGs have had?
It's been important. I mean, I think, first of all, they came out after, I guess, a decade or so of the Millennium Development Goals, which I don't think many people really understood at all. So I think the rise of the SDGs is important because it's the first time a framework has come out that I think, by and large, people understand. So they see the SDGs. They see them divided across environmental, social, and economic priorities. And whether you're in business or in government or just an individual consumer or citizen, those resonate with you because those are things that we all profess to care about. We want economic security, we want environmental health, and we certainly want social well-being. So in that regard, I think they've been enormously impactful. I think they've also been enormously impactful from the standpoint of companies in the sustainable business perspective or from that perspective because it's forced companies to acknowledge that there are these sort of three legs of the sustainability stool. And whereas some companies used to sort of claim greenness and environment, now those companies are recognizing social well-being and vice versa. So I think for those reasons, they've been really important.
And of course, businesses were involved in their development, which is the big difference between those, the SDGs and the Millennium Development Goals. That business involvement surely was key.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And I think this is a great example of how having a wide range of stakeholders at the table, government, NGO, and business, can make a big difference in coming up with a framework that makes a lot of sense to a lot of people.
We've heard a lot about science-based targets as well the last day or so. What impact do you think that shift has been? I mean, is this using science-based targets, is this when finally you can get senior business management to really see, well, this is where we fit into the bigger picture. This is what we have to do to achieve the broader sustainable development picture that everyone talks about.
That's, I think, a very interesting question. And it's reminiscent to me of earlier dialogue we had about science-based decision-making. Who doesn't want to make decisions based on science? Of course, everybody wants to participate in that. Yet what we found there is that you could have the best science in the world, access to the best and most plentiful information, and still make really lousy decisions. And I think we're seeing the same thing with science-based targets. So don't get me wrong. I think science-based targets are important. I think they point the way or can point the way. I think the challenge there is that, and it goes back to your first question around how we define materiality. You know, it's that the targets themselves, though they may be based on science, may not be terribly relevant either to the decision context that we're dealing with or to the stakeholders that are important to us. So there's a real comfort in knowing that you have a science-based target and you can proceed with it. But without some really clear thinking ahead of how you set those targets, they could lead you down the same dark path as you might be on if you didn't have those targets to begin with.
So it's sort of a bit like the kind of certification debate, but taken over to the science-based target debate then, perhaps.
Yeah, exactly. And I, you know, I think at the end of the day, for me, it's not so much about science-based targets or materiality, because as I said, those things are all really critical. It's how those things are designed, implemented, and ultimately used. And the analogy that I like to give is if you look at any corporation, they'll have a massive budget devoted to marketing. They'll have a massive amount of talent in the marketing department, just as they'll have a massive budget and a massive amount of talent in the economics of their business, the division that deals with finance and economics. R&D and engineering, also huge budgets and really talented teams. And then how much effort do those same organizations devote to building capacity on the inside with respect to things like decision support, which encompasses how we do materiality well, how we come up with the appropriate targets, and then how we actually use that information in strategic decision making. And those budgets and those teams are tiny by comparison. Yet I think that's such an important aspect of where a company goes. I think that happens because people assume that we have expertise. And because we have expertise, we're going to be great decision makers. But there's a wealth of research out there that shows that's not
sure
the case.
What are the business initiatives that you're getting excited about right now? We talked about some of them already, but you know, what are the other ones that you think are really worth following?
I'm really excited by the businesses out there that are able to articulate decisions they've made based on trade-offs that either are acceptable or not acceptable to them. So I take an example in apparel like Patagonia, who as an organization, as a company, seems prepared to take stands on social issues They seem prepared, and they have demonstrated that they are prepared as a company to leave money on the table when it comes to some of the traditional markets that they've served in the past. And in making those kinds of choices, they've been able to articulate why they're not going into certain areas. So I think to the extent that that's happening in many companies now, certainly I think when you look at some of the larger electronics and software companies, the IT space, you're seeing that happen a little bit more. I'm looking for that to spill into other sectors of the economy and to other kinds of businesses. So that's one. And the other is organizations, companies that are addressing the challenge I mentioned a few minutes ago, which is that they're building capacity internally and decision support. And I think here we see that happening with larger firms that deal with engineering or utilities, where they recognize that decision support in terms of weighing the pros and cons of different courses of action are going to be really critical, either because they have to meet regulatory or statutory requirements, or because they want to invest wisely. You're seeing this in finance as well. Those very same tools that banks and engineering firms are using to make portfolio choices within the organization, those tools could be ported out to other sectors of the economy, other businesses, apparel, food and agriculture, you name it. So the fact that organizations, companies are doing that is exciting. The fact that others could do it if they want to is also exciting. And the fact that they're not yet doing it, I mean, is also really exciting because it means that people like you and people like me have something to do tomorrow.
Sure. It was really interesting earlier on. We had a case study on Mondelez's Cocoa Life program, and it was fascinating. It was really a specific case study, but there was so much people in the room who had nothing to do with cocoa supply chain really were able to take a lot away from it and asking really interesting questions, engaging around how they can take the things that have been learned by Mondelez and their partners and apply them to their own business. So there's a lot of exciting stuff happening. Joe Avai, Professor of Sustainable Enterprise at the University of Michigan and Director of the Urban Institute, thank you very much.
Ian, thank you, and glad to see you in Detroit. Come back
thank
soon.
You. Thank you very much.
Don't forget to check out Innovation Forum's 2019 events calendar and get those dates in your diary. But that's it for now. I've been Ian Welsh, and I'll be back next week. Until then, goodbye.